Morning. It's one of those mornings. So it's Transfiguration Sunday, when we remember that Jesus, as like the way Lindsay put it, went on a little hike with some friends and then saw something tremendously strange. Now, it's often unfair to judge ancient writing by modern standards. But there are benefits to using modern storytelling ideas to help better understand ancient writing, especially like the Gospels, which are pretty carefully put together and written. And one of the standards for modern like novel writing, movies, TV shows, stuff like that, is that if something does not explain something more about the characters or advance the plot, remove it. And sometimes this isn't noticed, but it's felt. Have you ever watched a movie and been like, why are they, this is redundant, or this just makes no sense, this has nothing to do with anything, what was the editor thinking? That's probably what was happening. And hopefully it's not too blasphemous to say, but for me, the Transfiguration sometimes feels like that. It doesn't tell us anything new. In fact, we've got basically everything about Jesus, especially this late in Matthew, already. And it doesn't really advance the plot, so to speak. Jesus is already well on his way to Jerusalem. We already know who he is. We know what's going to happen. And so it just kind of leaves me wondering, other than this obviously made an impression, especially on Peter, why? And I don't have necessarily a clean answer for that. But there is a lot that's happening around it that I think can help us understand why this is so significant. About a week before this, they were in Caesarea Philippi. And Jesus starts asking, you know, who are people saying that I am? And Jesus doesn't really strike me as the insecure type, so I don't think he's like wondering, you know, what are my poll numbers like or something like that. Because they're pretty good at this point. They're about to go way downhill. But I think he's trying to get his disciples to really think and meditate on everything that they've seen and then ask themselves the question, where does this moment fit in the big, broad history of Israel? And it's in this moment, a week before the Transfiguration, that Peter, of all people, who has the, what do they call it, the foot and mouth disease, because he's always just saying something stupid, he says, well, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And I just, in my own imagination, I see Jesus going, huh. Out of all of us, I didn't think you would get that one. Now, I'm not being very kind to Peter, but there's a reason for that. And in fact, Jesus affirms what Peter says. Yeah, I am the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Don't say anything. Because the story is not going to go how you think it's going to go. I'm going to go to Jerusalem, and I'm going to die. And I know I've said this many times, in that world and at that time, we have about a dozen on record Messiah-type movements on either side of Jesus' life. They all, including the Jesus story, all ended with their death, and then that was the end of the movement. Nobody, except for this one weird situation, nobody after the death of their leader said, you know what, I think he actually was the Messiah. That doesn't make any sense. So then Peter says, and I'm paraphrasing, absolutely not. And then Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. So Peter's had a weird day. And he's not actually saying, like, the devil is taking control of you. But when Peter said, no, you're not going to die, he's speaking contrary to the plan of God. And that's not a good thing. And Jesus says a few other things at this point that like the cost of being a disciple, you will take up your cross and follow me. And again, that's a weird thing to say because Jesus hasn't been crucified yet. They don't know where this story is going necessarily. But what it does tell us is that everybody at that time knows what crucifixion is. That the way of Jesus is going to be marked by suffering and darkness. And so a week later, we come to this moment, Matthew 17, and Jesus essentially says, all right, you three, follow me. The rest of you, just sit down. Just don't do anything weird. And of course, he comes back down, and they're basically in an argument about all kinds of things because there's a demonic encounter and they can't do anything about it. And you can just imagine Jesus going, oh, come on. And the rest of his, or the Peter, James, and John going, guys, you're just not going to believe what I saw. But in the meantime, Jesus picks Peter, James, and John, and they seem to be preparing for leadership, so to speak. And Peter, as we see in the opening chapters of the book of Acts, Peter is the de facto leader of the Jesus movement, and he is until about chapter 15, and then he vanishes from the story, and we never hear from him again. Again, I don't know. John is with Peter every step of the way, in those, especially in those early years. James seems to be floating around not too far behind, and he's the first of the 12 to be executed. So the three that Jesus calls up are in for a bumpy ride and they have no idea. Nevertheless, they go up onto a mountain and Elijah and Moses appear. And it's always tricky to try and suss out why Elijah and Moses. One explanation that on the surface seems really plausible is that, well, they represent the law and the prophets. Moses, the lawgiver, Elijah, one of the great prophets. Except Moses is considered a prophet, not the lawgiver. And Elijah he was not one of the prophets that wrote anything down. So while there is a parallel there, I don't think that's quite what is happening here. And in fact, the funny thing is that they both have at least one thing in common that is suddenly going to have something in common, all three of them, Elijah, Jesus, and Moses, is that their lives or their careers, we could say, are marked by immense suffering and struggle and frustration. The source of a lot of that suffering, struggle, and frustration, of course, is people. You can draw your own conclusions. We're all part of the problem. But the other thing that they have in common that seems pretty pretty remarkable is that the narrative surrounding the death of Moses is tricky. And there's just enough weirdness that later Jewish tradition, so the tradition that was alive and well around the time of Jesus, looked at him and saw him as one of the so-called deathless ones. Elijah, much more straightforward, was simply taken up into heaven. The chariots come around, vroom, pick him up, and he vanishes, and his protege, Elisha, is standing there, again, one of the many, saying, this is a strange day. So, within that first century kind of Jewish world, I think Peter, James, and John are sitting there seeing the two deathless ones. Why Enoch wasn't there, I have no idea. And they're standing there having a conversation with Jesus, who just a week ago said that he is going to die. I think the meaning of the transfiguration within the story of Jesus' life is somewhere in that tension. Both of those things are true at the same time. Jesus is the Messiah. He is the Son of the living God. And he is in for a world of pain and suffering. Literally, a world of pain and suffering. He is taking on the darkness and destruction of the world. And at the same time, he stands with those who seem to have defeated death, or at least escaped it. One of the ways to look at the rest of the story is to ask the question, how can those both be true at the same time? Now, Peter, of course, decides to open his mouth because, of course, he has no impulse control, which I appreciate. And he says, hey, I'll build a couple of tents. How about that? Like shelters, tabernacles. And it seems to indicate, one, he doesn't exactly know what's going on, doesn't really know what to do, but at the same time, he wants to stay in that place. And I get that. It's very clear that Peter does not understand this moment, but he wants to be here. Doesn't want to leave. Now, to my mind, that makes me think of like vacations. We, you go on a vacation, you're gone for a week, 2 weeks, however long, and usually by the end, if you do it right, you're going, oh, I'm just ready to be home. But I think at least for some of us, if not many of us, if not all of us, we've had a few vacations that are so spectacular, you just want to stay. I remember, gosh, this was longer ago than I can count, which is not very high anyway. But my aunt and uncle took Katie and I, my wife and I out, and for a couple of days, we got to stay at Pebble Beach. I don't play golf. My brother does. So while he and my uncle played golf, I got a massage at the spa. Much better way to spend my time, I think. One of our dinners in like their main restaurant, we had quite literally the best Cabernet that Napa Valley offers. It was the Schaefer Hillside Select. I think the year was 84, but I can't remember for sure. It was remarkable. I didn't want to leave. That's not something that you want to go home from. In fact, I'd love to have stayed there for the rest of my very, very slovenly life. But that would defeat the purpose. A vacation is nice for rest and recuperation. It's not meant to be forever. It's meant to give you some rest, some recuperation, and lift you so that you can kind of launch back into real life. If we take that idea and ask, how does the transfiguration moment reflect that? Well, Peter, James, and John are about to, as they walk with Jesus, witness some deeply dark moments. I would argue one of the darkest moments of human history. And it's no coincidence that Jesus tells them as they're coming down the mountain, I imagine going, what is happening? You saw that, right? The guys, okay, good. We're not having an issue here. As they come down the mountain, Jesus says, don't say anything until I've been raised from the dead. Now again, the concept, the category of being raised from the dead did exist in a very small group within the Jewish world. But nobody, literally nobody expects at that point somebody to rise from the dead ahead of time. So now they're caught between yet another tension. This is a story all about tension, if you haven't noticed. of Jesus saying, don't say anything until kind of the unthinkable happens, and then the unimaginable happens as a result. At the same time, you've just witnessed a moment that is absolutely, 100% truly unique in all of the world, in all of human history. How do you come off of that mountain and not be the same person? I don't think you do. And I wonder if the three of them kind of had little meetings or something, saying, all right, we can't talk about it with anybody else, but what did we see? Well, it's no coincidence that that this Wednesday begins the season of Lent. Ooh, all right, deep breaths. Which is the period of 40 days where we turn our eyes towards the suffering and death of Jesus. It has consistently been a time in the church year where Christians have fasted. They have used this time to consider repentance, to examine themselves, and perhaps ask, why? Why did Jesus come and endure death for us? With that echoing in the backs of our minds, as we go through our midweek services on Wednesday, noon and 7 o'clock, if you're not aware, we'll be looking and exploring and meditating on the Book of Lamentations. If you've not read Lamentations, I would encourage you to do so, but heads up, it's dark. It is written in the face of exile. As a response to exile, after the writer has witnessed the destruction of everything he knows and loves. And I chose that because it feels like we in our society talk a lot about grief and sadness, but we don't really know what to do with it. Our culture is not one that loves things that are uncomfortable. In other words, we don't know how to lament. And so my hope and prayer is that over the next 6 weeks, as we meditate on the Book of Lamentations, God will show us what it means to lament in a way that both honors the pain and suffering that we've experienced, the pain and suffering that we've caused, and how we can give voice to that suffering in a way that honors what God has done for us. In that same vein, as Jesus has shown Peter, James, and John that there is so much more going on than they understand, like an infinite amount more than what they really get at that moment. What they've had a glimpse of is the defeat of death. Human beings can endure basically anything if they can put it to story. If that pain, that suffering, that thing to be endured has meaning, it's amazing what we can get through. However, if we lose track of that meaning, we don't do so well. For whatever else that moment of transfiguration is, it's a window into Peter, James, and John's experience, but I think also a suggestion for us as well. That when times are hard, Jesus, in some really hard to explain way, has already gone before us. That as things are going to get really tough for these three and for the rest of his disciples, meaning Peter, James, and John are meant to be kind of the bedrock of that group, that they're the ones that are going to know to hold on to the fact that no matter how bad it gets as Jesus goes to his tortured grave, that's not where that story is going to end. In the same way, the transfiguration is a reminder to us that maybe the wall, the separation between the world as we know it and God's divine sacred presence is not as thick as we thought it was. That in fact, God, by God's Spirit, He's constantly breaking in and revealing Himself to us in maybe surprising ways. But the point of all of those divine human moments that we might or that we might experience, and the ways that we tell our story in such that or as such that God has intervened in my life and rescued me from myself and those around me, that it all comes down to that moment as Jesus is walking with them down the mountain, reminding them, I'm going to be raised from the dead. That's when you start talking. And so for the rest of us, maybe you've had mountaintop experiences, maybe you haven't. Maybe you know what it's like to live in the valley. And you yearn for that mountain. Regardless, out of all the many ways that God may have interacted and intervened and inspired you in your life, the point is that Jesus, His Son, broken into our existence, our reality, the very world He created, has done so in order to defeat death and defeat the darkness within us. And if that is the direction our story is always headed, whether it feels like it or not, whether we realize it or not, and so therefore the story that we tell about ourselves and about what we endure is one that we know will end in new life, suddenly things can become, or we can become, a lot more resilient because we follow the one who has been raised from the dead. And if the final words over His life and death are life and resurrection, the same will be true for us, come whatever else may. Amen. As you are able, please rise.